In today's podcast, I'm joined by the globally well-renowned Christopher Cost. He initially worked on projects such as public transport, complete streets, and transit-oriented development in India at the Institute for Transportation and Development Policy, also referred to as ITDP. He currently heads up African transport sustainability initiatives in Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Uganda. It's great to have you share your expertise with us today, Chris. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
African cities are increasingly urbanizing at a rapid rate. How will this affect the future of mobility in the city?
Well, certainly in many cities, the transport infrastructure is really overstretched. And so far, the solution has been to try to widen the roads for cars. And the problem is that this only serves a minority of the residents. And in most cities, you know, most people are using public transport, they're walking and they're cycling. And if you take Nairobi, for example, we have about 40% of daily trips by foot, 41% by public transport, and only 13% of the residents are using cars. And so we're developing the infrastructure for this minority. And when you build the wider roads, you just create more, you invite more vehicles to come onto those roads and create more congestion. And that doesn't solve the problem. So I think, Anazi, can we go back? Because I botched one word in that first sentence. So I think we should just go back and start again.
Yes. Let's do it. Do you want me to ask the question again?
I think, I think maybe we just go back to the beginning of the whole thing. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No stress. 5. In today's podcast, I'm joined by the globally well-renowned Christopher Cost. He initially worked on projects such as public transport, complete streets, and transit-oriented development in India at the Institute for Transportation and Development Policy, also referred to as ITDP. He currently heads up African transport sustainability initiatives in Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Uganda. It's great to have you share your expertise with us today, Chris. Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
So, African cities are increasingly urbanizing at a rapid rate. How will this affect the future of mobility within the city?
Sure. Well, today the mobility system in many African cities is definitely overstretched. And so far the response has been to just widen the roads and try to make more space for cars. But the issue is that in most of our cities, the majority of residents aren't using cars. Like, they're traveling by public transport, they're walking and cycling. If you take Nairobi as an example, you know, here we have 40% of daily commuters using just walking to wherever they're going, and then another 41% taking public transport. And we only have about 13% of trips by car. And so these investments are only serving a minority of the residents. And what happens after a pretty short period of time is that these wider roads just get filled up with more cars. And so you have more vehicles back at the same level of congestion, but producing more pollution and wasting everyone's time. And so a better approach is to, instead of building more roads and flyovers and elevated highways, to actually use our road space more efficiently. Carve out dedicated space for public transport. It could be in the form of a BRT, you know, create dedicated cycle lanes or footpaths. And that way we'll be able to provide a more inclusive and resilient mobility system that actually serves all the residents and to really respond to that, you know, breakneck pace of urbanization that you're talking about.
Speaking of air pollution, Rwanda is one of the few African countries to have taken positive steps in managing air pollution. Why do you think that's the case? And what can other countries across Africa learn from Rwanda?
Sure. Well, I'd start by pointing out one really fundamental but often overlooked aspect of what Rwanda's been doing, and that is that they've been developing basic walkways on all of their main streets. They've also been creating safe crossings and ensuring that vehicles actually stop for pedestrians and give people the right of way at those crossings. So that's a fundamental pillar that's there in Kigali and other cities. Another thing that's happening in Kigali is that just recently the city has started setting up a modern bike share system where people can check out cycles and take them for short trips. It also helps improve last mile access to public transport. And so that's the kind of innovative, you know, mobility system that gives people an alternative to using their own cars and helps reduce pollution in the process. I'd also point to what Rwanda's been doing as far as public transport reform is concerned. So starting in 2012, the country put out a new public transport policy, and that kicked off the process of working to formalize the informal public transport operators. And so the government worked with the minibus operators to help consolidate and form a bus operating company, and also to invite other private investors. And so two additional bus operating companies came up in Kigali. And with those companies in place, they were able to make some important reforms. So one was that drivers were then on salary. So their income wasn't just dependent on the number of people they carried every day, and they could get time off and other benefits. And the city also introduced smart card fare collection. So the bus operators don't collect cash on the buses anymore. You can pay with a smart card. And then finally, they started replacing the old fleet with more modern and less polluting buses. So all these measures together have ensured that people can move around without cars, that they have dignified, transport facilities that they can use. And these are some of the key measures that have been helping to reduce pollution in the city.
That is quite interesting. I just want to ask, what minibus taxis are they using? Are they electric, or are they hybrid cars, or what makes them more energy efficient?
Well, so far they're conventional diesel vehicles, but the city is in the process of studying the options for introducing e-vehicles. So the IFC has commissioned a study on that, and we should start to see some cleaner vehicles coming in soon.
Mm. Is Rwanda the only country ahead of the curve, or are there other countries doing things differently at the moment?
So there are a lot of countries taking inspiring steps. I think Ethiopia is another one that's been really demonstrating that it's possible to develop, you know, high quality facilities for walking and cycling. The city of Addis Ababa adopted a walking and cycling strategy a few years back, and then the national government followed suit. And so there's also a federal non-motorized transport policy. And there have been important institutional reforms. So the Ministry of Transport at the federal level set up a non-motorized transport committee that looks after these various initiatives to improve the walking and cycling environment. And they've been working with individual agencies to make sure that that walking and cycling projects are incorporated in the budgeting process, and also ensuring that the capacity of regional governments and cities is improved, so that they're in a better position to develop sustainable mobility plans and also design good walking and cycling facilities throughout the country.
Wow. Going back to Rwanda and its air quality, they've introduced car-free Sundays. Can you explain how this works and how they're actually implementing it?
Sure. You know, the basic idea is to open up several kilometers of streets for pedestrians and cyclists so that they no longer have to compete with vehicles. And this started back in 2016. So the car-free days have been running for quite some time. And now they've expanded to four different zones within the city. So several districts have their own car-free areas, and that gives residents more access. And yeah, I think Kigali has seen great results. You know, there's even been work shown that's shown that pollution levels have declined alongside these car-free events. So you can really see the impacts. And it's also been really inspiring for other cities. So now, you know, it's not just Kigali, but we have several cities across the region. You know, whether it's Kisumu in Kenya, or Cape Town, or Douala in Cameroon, you know, all these cities have started implementing car-free days. And hopefully we can see this expand around the continent.
Yeah, certainly. I think it's a good idea. Obviously, with less cars on the road, do you think this will increase walking activity?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, one of the immediate impacts is when you reduce the number of cars on the road, you have a lot fewer conflicts between cars and pedestrians and also the cyclists. So that encourages more people to come out. I think one important point is that it's not just about reducing the number of moving cars, but also the number of parked cars, you know, because on-street parking is such a poor use of our valuable public space. And if we can work to repurpose some of those parking spaces and shift the vehicles to off-street parking areas, you know, then we'll have a lot of opportunities to repurpose that street space for wider walkways or protected bike lanes or things like that. So yeah, we definitely need to make that transition, get the cars out and make more space for walking.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. And obviously this brings in city planners, right? City planners are faced with the task of now building infrastructure or designing the city so that it promotes, you know, walking and it creates a safe space for walking. What do you think are some of the challenges they are facing right now, and how do you think they can overcome them?
Yeah, one of the biggest challenges in many of our cities in the region is that we lack proper street networks. And so what happens is, if you're trying to access a shop or reach the nearest bus stop, you have to take a long detour because we don't have a good street grid. And so this ends up discouraging walking trips. You know, a lot of people end up jumping in the car if they have one, or taking Uber instead. And so we need to ensure that they're fine-grained street networks, you know, so that you can access nearby destinations without having to take a circuitous route. And in order to do this, we can create a variety of streets. You know, they can be large and small streets, but they need to be public streets, so they shouldn't be behind gates. And they should result in very small blocks. So we shouldn't have urban blocks that are larger than 100 meters on a side. And that way we can create better interconnected networks that serve lots of local trips and help people make these trips by foot or by cycle instead of having to get into a vehicle. And it, you know, sometimes it may seem like this is really hard to do if we have an existing built-up area, but even in that case, can work with developers and change our planning regulations so that if a plot redevelops and it's on a really large block, then we can ensure that the developer puts in new streets and new pedestrian cut-throughs to improve access in that area. And then in newly developing areas, there we have an even bigger opportunity to ensure that the street network is set up well from the start, and maintain those small block sizes. So this is something that's really key when we're developing, when cities are expanding, because if we get the street network right, then a lot of other things will fall into place. You know, we can use the land efficiently, we can develop at a higher density, and we can encourage the use of more sustainable modes rather than forcing everyone into private vehicles.
Do you think this is going to require quite a lot of investment, and who is it going to come from?
Yeah, it can be a combination of private and public investment. I mean, I think for starters, the key is to identify where these new streets are going to be. So we have to have clear land use plans, especially on the urban fringe, so that instead of haphazard development, you know, we actually identify where those new streets are going to be. And then when development comes, it can factor in the location of those streets so that you don't have to come back later and acquire land or you know, try to condemn existing properties that are there to create that street network. And certainly in the redevelopment process, you know, we can ensure that developers actually invest in this public space. And, you know, instead of just building one big gated compound, you actually create this public street network so that there's permeability through the project. And there are lots of good examples of that in South Africa and other countries where these type of development patterns are taking hold. But we have to really change the way that we're developing and not just think about cars and developing a network for cars, but actually thinking about the pedestrian and cycle networks and how people can get to services and public transport stops easily and quickly.
I'm just glad you mentioned South Africa. I'm glad we feature somewhere positive.
Yeah, there are great developments there. And I think because, you know, the whole new urbanist movement has taken on with, you know, sometimes good, sometimes bad results. But there are good examples of developments that aren't just surrounded by locked gates, you know, where there's been an effort to create public streets. You know, the Melrose Arch is one example. And there are others where there's been a focus on, you know, creating a public realm and not just assuming that everyone is going to reach the development in a car.
Yeah, definitely. So you've mentioned some solutions, and I think one particular one is how city planners can create safe zones for pedestrians, because we're obviously facing quite a lot of fatalities and a risk to safety, I'd say. So are there any other solutions that we could work on that would apply to a typical African urban setting?
Yeah, I would say that to improve safety, we really need to focus on street design, because a lot of times road safety dialogue, you know, just looks into speed limits and enforcement and things like that. But the design of our streets also has a huge impact on whether people can travel safely. And the fundamental point here is that we can't keep designing our urban streets as highways and then expecting better results. You know, we actually have to change the designs. And the bottom line is that we shouldn't have urban streets with speed limits above 50 kilometers per hour. And in special zones like around schools, the speed should be even lower, like say 30 kilometers per hour. And so we need to ensure that those speed limits are there by design. You know, it's not just a signposted speed limit, but we're actually designing the streets with traffic calming measures and elements that encourage vehicle users to slow down. The other thing is that, you know, oftentimes the knee-jerk reaction, if there seems to be a road safety black spot, is to say, let's just build a footbridge. But, you know, footbridges are not pedestrian infrastructure. You know, they're mainly intended to speed up cars, you know, to get the pesky pedestrians out of the way so that cars can move faster. But they're inaccessible, especially for people with disabilities. You know, they increase the time it takes to cross the street. We realized that at one of the footbridges along the BRT corridor in Dar es Salaam, you know, it took us 3.5 minutes just to cross the two bus lanes and two mixed traffic lanes. And so if you think that when we're planning our mass transit systems, we're trying to maximize the number of people who can live within a 5-minute walk of a BRT station. If it takes you 3.5 of those minutes just to cross the street, then you're really cutting the potential catchment area down, and you're not maximizing the benefit of that investment in the BRT system. So we need to stop building these footbridges in urban areas and you know, build safe at-grade crossings. They can either have traffic calming to slow down the vehicles, or they can have traffic lights. There are many African cities that are already doing that. You know, one notable example is Accra in Ghana, where they have at-grade crossings that have lights and people stop at the red lights and let people cross. So let's do that in more cities and make it safe for people.
Yeah, that's definitely, we really need to do that. And I'm actually glad you mentioned vulnerable groups, just like people who are disabled, women and children as well. And that's definitely a topic that we're also going to touch on later in our conference. But how can we monitor? It's fun to have the right street design, but how do we actually now get on the ground and monitor the safety and fatalities in our urban areas streets?
Yeah, we need to start collecting more data on all aspects of walking and cycling, you know, so we need to know where people are moving. We need to know pedestrian cycle volumes on different streets so that we can prioritize the infrastructure. And we also need to know where we're running into safety challenges. So we need to have geolocated crash data so that we can map out the black spots. And the data should be publicly available. You know, I think a lot of governments are hesitant to release road safety data, but it's really important for street designers to have that information so that when there are cases of black spots, then they can really zero in on those locations and do intersection retrofits, install the traffic calming, install better crossings to help solve the problem. So it's not only a matter of collecting the data, but ensuring that we have open access so that we can act on the information that's there.
Exactly. How effective do you think panic buttons are? Do you think that's something that could work in such a big area? Can we scale it, or do you think that only works for closed gated communities?
No. So push button control crossings are great. We need to have enforcement. So, you know, the authorities need to take the enforcement of pedestrian crossings as seriously as they do other aspects of traffic rule enforcement. And so in cities like Kigali, there are actually traffic officers appointed to monitor pedestrian crossings, and that needs to be the case in all of our cities, so that road user behavior actually changes. And I think there are good precedents for that transformation. So, you know, one example would be on the BRT corridor in Dar es Salaam, where, you know, there was clear training of the bus drivers on the BRT corridor to stop for pedestrians at the crossings. And, you know, and over time, people realized that they were actually going to, you know, get the right of way. And so they started demanding that of the private vehicles as well. And so now even the cars stop at those same crossings. So there's been that whole behavior shift. And you know, and we can see that if we have the political will to really ensure that the way that we manage our streets is equitable and you know, and doesn't ignore the majority of users who are walking.
Yeah, I'm so glad there's a behavioral shift, because it actually really does start with the mindset. But now let's touch on COVID. COVID has had its positives and its negatives when it comes to public transport. And we know public transport does affect our walking and cycling. So what key takeaways can we learn from the lockdown, and how do we implement them?
Sure. Well, yeah, public transport systems definitely took a beating during the pandemic. And in many cases, fares went up. There were limits on occupancy. And, you know, and so this made public transport a lot less affordable for a lot of the commuters. And, you know, many cities around the world responded to this by taking the chance to repurpose their street space. So, you know, when we had less traffic during the initial lockdowns, you know, using that time period to introduce bus lanes so that we can speed up the public transport vehicles, but also doing the same for pedestrians and cyclists. So creating tactical bike lanes and then eventually making them permanent. And I think we need to see this in a much bigger way in the Africa region, because cycling can be a good, you know, healthy alternative during the pandemic. And anecdotally, a lot of cities have seen a surge in interest in cycling. You know, bike prices have gone up substantially, and it's much harder to find cycles these days. But we need to see the road infrastructure catch up with that, you know, so that all of our main arterial streets with two or more lanes have protected bike lanes. And that way we can, you know, build on the momentum that's already there, where more and more people are getting interested in cycling and actually make it safe for everyone. You know, so it's not just the middle-aged male cyclists who are out there, but, you know, we can have women, children also feeling safe getting out on bicycles.
Exactly. You actually touch on a very good point. You say that bicycle prices have gone up, right? What is that actually going to do now to people who want to cycle but can't afford to buy a bike?
People have trouble, you know, finding bikes, and especially those who would benefit the most from, you know, switching to cycling and saving on the public transport fares. It means it's been that much harder for them to make that move. And so we've seen a lot of countries now, you know, looking at whether they can encourage the local cycle manufacturing industry. So that's a really positive move. There's also been interest in reducing tariffs on bicycle imports, because in many countries, you know, there's a push to, you know, have lower import tariffs on electric vehicles. But why not do the same for bicycles? Because that's the ultimate, you know, low emissions mode. So we need to take whatever steps we can to make cycling more affordable, and to create the supporting infrastructure, you know, whether it's the bike lanes or safe cycle parking, in order for more people to take it up.
Wow, very interesting. Thank you so much, Chris. I'm sure our audience has learned a lot about what it takes to create a safe environment for walking. Thank you to Christopher Koss, the Africa Program Director at the Institute for Transportation and Development Policy. And I, your host, Anazi Zotepiper. Thank you for joining this podcast on Smarter Mobility Africa Digital.